This hour's top stories, U.S. President Trump again accuses Democrats of vote fraud and election theft, saying his opponents are quote-unquote trying to rig the election. Two prominent Republican senators attacked the legitimacy of presidential vote results, while several other expressed frustration with President Trump's allegations of vote fraud. Also in the headlines, a UK Parliament watchdog says Britain's trade with the EU faces major disruption, regardless of whether a trade deal is agreed. Welcome to the program. U.S. President Donald Trump has once again hurled accusations of Democrats claiming they are engineering the presidential election.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on, and this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election, and we can't let that happen. Detroit and Philadelphia, known as two of the most corrupt political places anywhere in our country.
Trump added that if, quote, illegal votes are counted, he will easily win the presidential race. He once again lashed out at the mail-in voting system, calling it a one-sided method that benefits Democrats. Trump's campaign filed lawsuits to halt vote counting in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, while claiming vote irregularities in Georgia. State judges in Georgia and Michigan, however, have rejected the suits, citing lack of evidence. In the meantime, Democratic candidate Joe Biden expressed confidence that he will be elected as the next U.S. president after the vote counting process ends.
We have no doubt that when the count is finished, Senator Harris and I will be declared the winners. So I ask everyone to stay calm, all the people to stay calm. The process is working. The count is being completed, and we'll know very soon. So thank you all.
The Democratic candidate stressed that each ballot must be counted. The race is tight in Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Biden needs only six more electoral votes to secure the 270 required to win the nail-biter race. Trump has so far won 214. Final results can take days to be announced, as counting mail-in ballots is said to be a time-taking process. Republicans are divided over Trump's allegations of election fraud and his demand for stopping the vote count. Senator Mitt Romney said counting every vote is at the heart of democracy. He said the process is often long and frustrating, but that does not mean it should stop. Republican Representative for Illinois Adam Kinzinger said Trump should stop spreading debunked misinformation. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said there's no defense for Trump's post-election comments and urged him to respect the results. That's while two other Republican senators have supported the president. Ted Cruz said Pennsylvania's attorney general had ordered vote counting to continue in Philadelphia until Joe Biden wins. Lindsey Graham also said Philadelphia elections are crooked. Rival rallies have been held across the U.S. for the second straight night over the election vote fraud. President Trump supporters, some with weapons, gathered outside the vote counting facility in Las Vegas. That's the most populous city in the state of Nevada, where election ballots are still being processed. Trump supporters included members of far-right group Proud Boys. They carried flags that say, quote-unquote, "Don't steal my vote." Pro-Trump supporters gathered in New York and Philadelphia as well. Both cities also saw rival protests calling for every vote to be counted. Demonstrations were triggered on Wednesday after Trump claimed that he had been cheated out of winning the election. He has offered no evidence for his claim. Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. gives us an update on the vote counting process in the United States.
This is where we're seeing some ideological differences here. Now, when Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, says that the Pennsylvania Election Board will continue to count votes until former Vice President Joe Biden wins, well, you know, there's a little bit of truth to that, but it's not because they are cheating. It's because the fact that most of the votes that are coming in are typically going for the former vice president because a lot of Democrats decided that they were not going to vote in person. They also decided that they did not want the current president to be their president anymore. So they already knew who they were going to vote for weeks ago. So they mailed in their votes. But because of rules, the votes couldn't be counted until the day of voting, until voting day. Well, if you have an overwhelming amount of votes being cast and they're breaking records and then you can't really count the votes until a specific day, it's almost impossible to count all of the votes within a certain amount of hours.
Political analyst Mark Weber says the presidential election revealed deep divisions within American society.
Well, Donald Trump's bizarre remarks should not come as any kind of surprise, because even before Election Day, he repeatedly said that the only way he could lose the election would be through fraud, voter fraud, deceit, and vote tampering. Remarks like that 20 or 30 years ago would have instantly earned the scorn and contempt of most Americans. But things have changed. In the years ahead, I think people will look back on this year's U.S. presidential election campaign as a milestone of American decline, as a landmark in the fall of America's stature in the world, and as a time when the confusion, the division, the incoherence of American society became glaringly obvious. I don't mean just today or just in the context of the election campaign, but over the whole range of this past year, we've seen such strife, such division across the board in American society. Even 4 years ago, the election of Donald Trump itself was a clear symptom of just how frustrated, how angry and distrustful Americans have become, not only of the country's political institutions, of leadership, but also of the mass media, of the educational system, and even of each other.
17 states across the U.S. have reported record daily increases of COVID-19 infections as the country registers a record number of, check this out, over 123,000 new cases. Number of hospitalized patients continue to rise for the 11th day in a row, reaching over 52,500. Furthermore, the country's average daily fatalities also rose by to 850. Some cities and states have taken measures to curb the virus surge by imposing curfews or reducing gathering sizes. However, 17 out of 50 American states do not have mandatory mask rules. The pandemic has spread across the country but have affected the Midwest worse. Illinois and Texas are the leading states in the number of cases in the last 7 days. The World Health Organization says an explosion of COVID-19 cases is seen in Europe, while mortality rates are also rising in the continent.
We do see an explosion, you know, and in that sense, it takes only a couple of days to have in our European region an increase, for example, with 1 million cases. And we see little by little the mortality increasing as well.
The WHO's regional director for Europe warned that in only a couple of days, there will be an increase of 1 million cases in the continent. Hans Kluge also noted that the mortality rate is also rising, but at a slower pace. European governments have implemented strict lockdown measures to stem the second wave of the pandemic. On Thursday, the continent emerged as accounting for the largest number of infections in the world. A UK Parliament watchdog says Britain's trade with the European Union faces major disruption, regardless of whether a trade deal is agreed. A national, or actually the National Audit Office, said ports and businesses are not ready for January the 1st when the Brexit transition period ends. The body said the UK government is attempting to prepare new border controls, which pose high risks. The office added that the coronavirus pandemic will make the situation even worse. London and Brussels are engaged in intensive talks to work out their future trade ties. The prospects for a deal looks dim as lots of moot points remain. The U.S. administration has reportedly notified the Congress that it plans to sell sophisticated armed aerial drones to the United Arab Emirates. The sale includes 18 of such drones in a deal worth nearly $3 billion. That's, of course, according to Reuters, citing people briefed on the notification. Reuters says the notification is informal and the State Department should later send a formal one to Congress. But before the department does that, its weapons sales can be reviewed by the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Senate and House. Both committees even have the ability to block the sales. Their members have previously criticized the UAE's role in civilian deaths in the Yemen war. Last week, the U.S. administration also notified Congress of a potential sale of F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. Two prominent human rights groups have condemned the confrontation, the confirmation, that is, that Formula One is to hold a race in Saudi Arabia next year. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have criticized the decision over the human rights situation in Saudi Arabia. Amnesty has described the country's rights record as heinous. Human Rights Watch said the next year event in Saudi Arabia is a blatant attempt at sports washing. HRW said the event is part of a cynical strategy to distract from Saudi Arabia's human rights abuses. The kingdom has long been criticized for its rights record, including the detaining and torturing human rights defenders, as well as women's rights activists. Riyadh has defied calls by international rights bodies to improve the situation. Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has criticized the West's hegemony, saying things are moving in a different direction.
I'm not predicting the end of the United States or the West, no. I'm saying the era of hegemony of the West has ended. The ideological hegemony has ended. The West can no longer pretend to teach the rest of the world how to preserve the rights of its citizens. And things are changing. Things are moving in a different direction. That's why they resort to desperate measures.
Zarif said the U.S. is now resorting to desperate measures by applying sanctions illegally. He added that Washington, in fact, is punishing anyone who tries to observe Security Council Resolution 2231. Zarif stressed that the world would be a much better place if the U.S. changes its policy and approach. Iranian foreign minister made the remarks in Caracas, where he praised Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro for resisting what he described as a U.S.-coordinated campaign to oust him. Yemeni students graduating from the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a have celebrated their graduation by paying tribute to top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq.
The name of martyr Qasem Soleimani decorating the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a, the first graduates of the department walking down it, reviving the memory of Haj Qasem, who they carried his name as a title for their badge.
When we talked about the Persian language, it was impossible to learn it because of the international fight against it, and whoever spoke it was considered as the enemy of Islam. Today, however, we have proved to the world that we and the Iranian people are brothers, and Islam unites us.
Graduates expressed their overwhelming joy of this accomplishment, stressing that their choice name for the Soleimani badge comes at a critical time in light of American unilateralism reaching its peak.
Martyr Soleimani is a force in the region, and his support for the Palestinian cause requires us to revive his memory by naming a badge in his name.
The ceremony came after Hassan Erlu presented his credentials to the president of the Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, as ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen. This shows the depth of the Yemeni-Iranian relations, especially with the U.S. escalating its hostile policies towards the two countries and towards the resistance axis as a whole. Erlu's predecessor left Sana'a in September 2015, and in October last year, Iran's foreign ministry said the process of sending a new ambassador was hindered by attacks on the embassy.
While some Persian Gulf Arab states leaders rushed to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, Yemenis continued to reaffirm their support for the Palestinian cause. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The chairman of Myanmar's military-aligned Union Solidarity and Development Party calls the country's persecuted Muslim minority useless.
The Rohingya left happily as if they were going on a picnic, so it's really difficult for me to accept that they were running away from the military. I cannot accept useless people in our country.
Former military commander said his country will not give in to international pressure to admit to genocide against the Rohingya Muslims. Myanmar is under growing international criticism for the army crackdown on the Rohingya. The Buddhist government has, however, denied the accusation of genocide. In 2017, Myanmar's army carried out a brutal crackdown against Rohingya in Rakhine State, forcing hundreds of thousands of people to flee to neighboring Bangladesh.
These are Rohingya Muslims, a long maltreated group who is denied citizenship at home in Myanmar. They began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State after waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of migrations to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the United Nations calls it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Over 700,000 Rohingya fled to Bangladesh. Thousands more sought refuge in India and other neighboring countries. Those who survived tell stories of burning villages, murder, rape, and babies being thrown into fires. Myanmar's military officials claimed that what happened to the villages were a counter-offensive aimed at uprooting terrorism. But the United Nations slammed the army's actions as clearly disproportionate and without regard for basic principles of international law. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. These people now live in cramped temporary housing in the district of Cox's Bazar, waiting for a day to return home. The Rohingya want justice. They want those who committed the crimes against them to be held accountable. Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has been accused of failing to protect the minority group. Suu Kyi even rejected a UN report about the military's violence and defended her government's actions in the Rakhine State.
Myanmar requests the court to remove the case from its list. In the alternative, to reject the request for the indication of provisional measures submitted by the Gambia.
There were also talks of Rohingya repatriation, which never happened. Firstly, because Myanmar's government is unwilling to accept the refugees. And secondly, due to Rohingya Muslims fearing for their safety if they returned to their country. A UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. Given Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a selected group of countries around the world.
diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Your holy defense.
In the name of God, salam dear listeners and welcome to the program. The 1975 Algiers Accord was the agreement that Saddam had signed with Iran's shahs before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The accord set up the existing disputes between Iran and Iraq on the borders and the Arvand River. On September 17, 1980, Saddam tore up the Algiers Accord before the TV cameras and claimed Iraqi full control over the river. Then on September 22nd, the Iraqi army started an all-out aggression against the Islamic Republic of Iran along the common borders with Iran. Saddam sought three goals in invading Iran. First, he wanted to annul the Algiers Accord. Secondly, he wanted to separate Khuzestan province from the Iranian territory. And thirdly, he intended to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Iraqi dictator failed to achieve any of his ambitions of invading Iran. Therefore, as a result of 8 years of stiff resistance of the Iranian nation, he was forced to accept 1975 Algiers Accord again and give in to Iran's demands. Saddam, in his sixth letter to the then Iranian president, Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, while admitting the acceptance of the accord, wrote, "With this decision, anything has become clear, and thus everything that you wanted and stressed will materialize, and there remains nothing but exchanging of documents." The last British ambassador to Tehran, Anthony Parsons, wrote, after Saddam reaccepting of the Algiers Accord, "Saddam failed in invasion of Iran because of the Iranian resistance, and when he noticed that he could not dominate over Iran, he reneged on his conditions." After accepting the Algiers Accord by Saddam and withdrawal of the Iraqi forces from all of the occupied regions, it was the turn for implementation of other articles of the UN Security Council Resolution 598. The most important paragraph was the exchanging of POWs, declaration of the aggressor, and determination of the damages inflicted upon Iran. Former UN Secretary General Javier Pérez de Coya, in order to implement paragraphs 6 and 7 of Resolution 598, wrote a letter to Iran and Iraq on August 14, 1991 and asked the two countries to declare their reasons for the initiator of the war. This request faced with Iraq's ridicule, and the country presented a very hollow response on August 26, with a series of documents. But the Islamic Republic of Iran sent substantive documents in bulk form on September 15. The Iranian documents were based on Article 51 of the UN Charter pertaining to legitimate defense. The UN chief, after consultation with a group of his experts and studying Iranian and Iraqi documents, gave them to an impartial group. Finally, Dekoya announced his opinion on December 9, 1991, stressing in an official report that Iraq was the initiator of the war. Part of Article 6 of the report reads, "The outstanding event that I have mentioned in Article 5 under the title of violation of international rights and regulations was the September 22, 1980 attack on Iran, which, according to the UN Charter, internationally recognized principles and laws or international morals, is not justifiable and leads to the responsibility of hostility." The UN Secretary General also said in paragraph 7 of the report, "Even if, before the start of hostility, there had been some aggressions from Iran to the Iraqi soil, such aggressions cannot justify the Iraqi aggression to Iran, which would result in the continued occupation of Iran's soil, an aggression that breaches prohibition of usage of force, which is one of the authoritative principles of the international rights." The UN Secretary General's report on announcement of the aggressor was a great victory for Iran. Although there were very obvious documents and evidence on the issue, the international community had kept tacit for several years vis-à-vis the aggression. It was in fact the Iranian resistance that forced the UN to bow to the legal demand of Iran. After this UN move, Saddam wrote a letter to Iran's president. As a matter of fact, his intention of sending letters to Iran was to settle his differences with Iran temporarily and cause Iran not to insist on implementation of other paragraphs of the resolution. Some of the Western and Arabic radios and news agencies said that Saddam's second time accepting of the Algiers Accord indicated that he was the aggressor and initiator of war. German radio Köln said, "Saddam in 1980 started the war against Iran with ignoring 1975 Algiers Accord." Kuwaiti agency quoting Austrian diplomatic sources said, "Saddam, who submitted before Iran and accepted Iran's conditions for peace, has officially confessed the initiation of war against Iran." The Saudi radio, also quoting military experts, said, "Accepting Iran's conditions by Saddam is the reason for the regime's invasion of the Iranian soil." Dear listeners, during the eight-year imposed war, Saddam's supporters in the West and the East didn't let even a single resolution be approved at the UN Security Council against the Iraqi dictator. Their ultimate request was the declaration of ceasefire without even mentioning the necessity of pullout of the invading country from the occupied regions. The Western and Eastern powers and the regional cohorts and henchmen were seeking to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. They generously equipped Iraq with the state-of-the-art weaponry and provided it with the latest intelligence and logistical aids. Moreover, they assisted Iraq financially. Militarily, Saddam's army was the fourth army in the world with 1.8 million forces. It possessed 600 aircraft and 6,000 tanks. This army had gathered valuable experiences during the eight-year war. So, the Iraqi war machine had turned into a threat to the regional countries and the vested interests of the big powers. That's why they thought of annihilating this machine. It is naive to say that Saddam's aggression against Kuwait was only due to his ambition. There is ample documents and evidence to indicate that he invaded the southern neighbor upon the Washington's green light. This move gave the U.S. the pretext for military expedition together with its allies and accomplices to the region. The UN admission of Iraq's aggression against Iran was indeed to announce the expiry date of Saddam.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. India is attempting to make the semi-autonomous Kashmir region a lot less autonomous. There has been a crackdown on this region since August of last year, and now decade-old laws repealed. Those living in Indian-controlled Kashmir have protested, and now another shutdown has been implemented by New Delhi on the region. Local residents are defiant about Indian measures, especially those allowing others to buy land in this region instead of just locals, as the previous law had allowed. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program, and hopefully we will have an interesting debate right after this package.
A shutdown is being observed in Indian-controlled Kashmir after New Delhi amended and repealed a series of decades-old land laws of Kashmir. The new reorganization law issued on October 26, 2020, opens up all of Jammu and Kashmir to every Indian citizen and removes every restriction that prevented large land holdings. Allows the Indian armed forces to take over land wherever they desire and gives sweeping powers to the government to take over any land and property for industrial use and bring in big businesses to set up their shops. The October 26, 2020 order repealed 13 state laws and amends 14 laws. Experts say this is to further the agenda behind the abrogation.
The aim is very much, yes, to disempower the Muslim majority of the state of J&K, and in fact, to erase them in history and in culture. I think that that is something that is not a big surprise. The question is how successful they're going to be at doing it, and it's something that only time will tell.
According to historic date check, these laws were introduced to empower the majority Muslims who were suffering immensely under the non-Muslim rulers. Not only this, but the rights to buy and sell land in Kashmir were also confined to the people of Kashmir. Experts say India's move in Kashmir since August 5, 2019 has further internationalized this conflict.
Kashmir is a small blip on the international scenario, you know, but I think that it is gaining salience and it is gaining an advantage. We are gaining an advantage out of it simply. And one of the biggest sort of evidences of that is what happened with the Chinese so-called, not so-called, but actual incursion into Jammu and Kashmir territory in Ladakh.
In response to the shutdown call by Pro-Freedom Camp of Kashmir, shops and businesses remained closed. Huge number of government forces were seen guarding the streets to avoid law and order problems.
Almost seven decades ago, these laws were introduced to empower the Muslim majority of Kashmir. But today, when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is repealing and amending the same laws, the people of Kashmir are watching over helplessly. Experts say this move clearly depicts India's intentions in Kashmir. Shahana Butt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of London, Reza Kazim, Islamic Human Rights Commission, and out of Qom, Iran, Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi, peace and justice activist and researcher. Thank you both for being with us. Starting us off in London, with Reza, why do you think that New Delhi has increased its pressure on this region since last year in the way it has?
I think we've seen a change in dynamics of the Indian politics, in particular with the rise of the BJP in the recent decades, and the kind of way direction the whole of India has actually gone in terms of Hindu supremacies, and how that is being manifested upon all sections of Indian society. And this old, very old area, which is occupied Kashmir, which is something that is something that has very much been part of the Hindu supremacist agenda in terms of trying to make sure that it becomes very much part and parcel. And what we're seeing is a settler colonial project being manifested, and India being seen very much and seeing itself in the light of a colonial power, and doing the things that a colonial power does. And that's what's being enacted within the case of Kashmir.
Well, Sarbaz Ruhollah, your perspective on the overall goal of changing these various laws, particularly pertaining to this area?
It's quite clear that the Indian politicians in BJP, they have concluded that if they want to resolve, so-called from their perspective, resolve the issue of Kashmir, there is no other way except to change the demography of Kashmir. Because at the end, Jammu Kashmir is a Muslim majority state. Still, Jammu Kashmir was the only Muslim majority state of India. So because of this population of the Muslims over there and their take and their hold on the lands and their position over there, they were feeling that the issue of Kashmir is not going to be resolved as they wish. So that's why they start all these series of acts from August 2019 till today. In 2019, in August, we had the abrogation of Article 370, an article that was claimed to give Kashmir a limited autonomy. Actually, that even that limited autonomy was not implemented as it was supposed to be implemented based on the Constitution of India during all four decades. But that was abrogated. So there was an act of 35A under Article 370 of Indian Constitution that was actually giving three, four important points to the people of Kashmir. One, to define who is the resident, permanent resident of Kashmir, to define who can possess any immovable property in Kashmir, and who can get settlement and who can occupy the jobs in Kashmir. So by removing and by abrogation of the Article 370, 35A naturally was also, nullified. And after that, the first, step that took place, it was in May 2020, before this new law of land law, before this amendment of the law, in Kashmir, the event that took place was about the domicile law. Based on the domicile law, actually, they started to redefine who could be possibly resident of Kashmir.
Okay.
And you know that under the great pressure of the central government, almost 12.5 lakhs of the domicile certificates were issued for non-Kashmiris, for those who were already in Kashmir, but they were not Kashmiris.
Okay, stay with me, Sarbaz Ruhollah. Stay with me. Let me get Reza back on this discussion. Now, some experts have compared Indian tactics to Israeli tactics against Palestinians and point to the close relationship now between New Delhi and Tel Aviv. Your take on that side of things?
I think when we talk about settler colonialism and the idea of a settler colonial project, as I mentioned earlier, it is very much in line with the Zionist project that is going on in occupied Palestine. And the links, as you mentioned, are things that have become very strong in recent years. And it is something that we can see that some of the ideas that are being used within Indian occupied Kashmir are similar to the projects that the Israelis have enacted within occupied Palestine in terms of land grabs, in terms of reassignment of land, in terms of taking all those things. So what we're seeing is very much, in that line, in that kind of dynamics of legitimizing or trying to legitimize that what they're actually doing is very much part and parcel of what this whole thing is actually about. And as Saibaz Rohla actually explained very clearly, is that these laws are things that have actually been passed. And what we see within the Israeli Knesset is the same kind of things of passing these laws so that it gives it a framework of legality, legitimacy, etc., etc., which it basically neither of those things possess, because ultimately it is about colonization of land, it's occupation of a land. And what it ultimately leads to is that the discussion needs to go down the route of how this is going to be resisted, how it's going to be resisted by people on the ground, how it is going to be resisted and supported by people from outside of that area, in terms of making sure that those people are able to get their legitimate rights and so on. So those links that you're talking about are very much in the offing, and I think they're going, they have become strong, and I think they're going to become stronger. And I think what we need to think about is that all of those things are going to be start to be enacted over a period of time, regardless of what the government in India will actually be saying. And the resistance to those kind of laws being normalized within occupied Kashmir, there needs to be a resistance that also matches and takes into account that this is something that is very much in the offing, and this is how things are going to develop in that area. So I think it's very clear the direction in which these things are going to go.
Well, Saibaz Rohla, you heard Reza basically saying about how this is going to be resisted. Your take on that side of things, how do you think the people of Kashmir are going to continue to resist this type of pressure coming out of New Delhi?
You know, we have, as Madhubala Reza mentioned, we have this clear history of Palestine in front of us, and every and each person in Kashmir is aware about what's going to take place, and not only Kashmiri people. Everyone in the world knows what is going to be the next step of India, because the history of Palestine is in front of us. It started with land grabbing, it started with so-called selling and purchasing the lands of Palestinians. But history knows better than everyone that not more than 1% of the occupied lands of Palestine were those lands sold to the Jews. So the same thing is going to take is no Kashmiri is going to sell any land to anyone from outside. Let me make it very clear. Even not to Muslims of India. Kashmiris are not going to sell their lands to the Muslims of India, because it's not a matter of, it's not a religious matter, it's a political matter. By a sense, Kashmir issue is a political issue. We don't believe that it's an, you know, religious issue. It's not an issue related to Islam and Hinduism. That's what, you know, BJP want to portray. So Kashmiris are not going to sell their lands. But as what we observed in occupied lands of Palestine, it's not a matter of purchasing the lands. It is, it's actually providing an opportunity, providing an environment for Indians to start making, colonies. We know, and I know, and everyone else in Kashmir, any Kashmiri knows that the next step will be bringing, pandits, bringing those Hindus of Kashmir. Any Kashmiri is welcoming the Hindus of Kashmir. Pandits of Kashmir are most welcome. They are from Kashmir. They have been from Kashmir, and everyone in Kashmir is, you know, welcoming them back to their homeland, Kashmir. But now we are observing another colonial policy of Indians. They want to make colonies inside inside Kashmir, and actually those colonies will be the start point of the clashes in Kashmir. They will make, this move could make the condition of the Kashmir much more worse than the current situation. That's what we have to observe. I mean, after the domicile law, now this new law, which is actually just removal of one sentence, there is no need to, if you want to purchase any land in Kashmir, there is no need to be the permanent resident of Kashmir. Because before this, based on the law that was, based according to 35A or 35A of the Indian Constitution, anyone who wants to buy any piece of land in Kashmir, he should be permanent resident of Kashmir. Okay. So now this has been removed. So
right.
Any other party from India can come to Kashmir and start purchasing the lands.
All right. Well, Reza, let me get Reza back into this. Reza, do you think that the international community should get involved in this issue in order to try to resolve it? or what do you see as being the key to trying to resolve this situation?
I think ultimately what you need to ask is the people of Kashmir what they actually want. And this is something that is fundamentally enshrined. And I think that means that there should be no interference from Delhi, there should be no interference from anyone else, and actually try and get that resolved in that kind of a way where the people of Kashmir have the right to determine their future and the right to decide what they're going to do in the future. And I think it's something that is fundamental in terms of how things are going to be move forward. I think any other option in terms of trying to divide up or carve up Kashmir is unacceptable to the people of Kashmir, and I think that's something that needs to be kept fundamentally very much in the minds of people. And we also need to think about that when we have interference, it needs to be kept, you know, the idea that somehow the people who created this mess and the powers that continue to create these messes, for example, the U.S., for example, you know, this is another colonial mess that is down to Britain, down to the UK, that has been created and has been left in this way. And those kind of people and those countries cannot be involved in that process because the solutions are not going to come from there. It's not going to be happening from there. So I think it needs to be something that is more regional, that needs to determine where things are actually going to go. And in terms of actually making those final decisions, it has to be down to the people of Kashmir as to where they will go and how they will determine their future and how they will figure out their political governance.
Well, Sarbaz Ruhollah, why doesn't the United Nations implement the UNSC Resolution 47, which states that India should hold a plebiscite and allow the Kashmiris to decide for themselves, as Reza was just talking about, if they want to be a part of Pakistan or India or independent?
Yeah, frankly speaking, the first problem that the United Nations has not discussed this issue of Kashmir. You know, there is no enforcement for what they have decided. This is the first problem. The second problem is with the both sides. Let's be very frank. United Nations in its resolutions have clearly mentioned that both India and Pakistan have taken their troops back, which is demilitarized. And United Nations has given just right to India to keep a minimum level of the number of the forces there to make the environment ready for the plebiscite. But nor India, neither Pakistan did not follow what United Nations asked them. And it actually messed up with the conditions, you know, after that, and nothing was changed, actually. And day by day, the situation of Kashmir became worse. The reality is that the Kashmir issue and the problem between India and Pakistan and Kashmir is not important for both, unfortunately. Let's be very frank. Even the Muslim, countries, even the Muslim Ummah, is not paying as it should pay attention to what's going on in Kashmir. Now we are at the edge of a new Palestine. Everything is ready for a creation of the new mess, new Palestine. Of course, Kashmir is there under pressure in all these, seven decades. But now their demography is under threat. And here by demography, even again, I want to make it very clear that we don't take it from the religious perspective, Hindu-Muslim issue. No. Let's be very frank towards this. The issue is about the new demographical change based on the colonial, agendas of India. They want to change Kashmir. And you should know that there is, of course, from the hardliners, from Hindu hardliners, from Hindu RSS groups inside India, that those sorts of, agendas against Kashmir, because they were believing that Kashmir is a holy land for Hindus. And it should return back again to Hindus, and these stuff is going on. This narration is also another part of the problem. We need a new Muslim countries, specifically those countries whom we can expect. Iran, Turkey, Malaysia, Indonesia, in collaboration with Pakistan, they should get together and they should put pressure on India. India has to accept Kashmir issue is an international issue. Also Pakistan, it's not a bilateral issue between Pakistan and India to resolve in between. It's what Pakistan has unfortunately accepted in 1971, 1972, the Chinda Agreement. where they accepted that Kashmir is an issue between India and Pakistan, which is not. Kashmir is an international issue. There are United Nations resolutions about Kashmir passed. Everyone and every just human being will confess that Kashmiri people have the right of determination and to decide about their future. And that should take place. India should accept it. But things we are living in 21st century. Things cannot be like this. They cannot suppress the people. 10 million people cannot be on the blockade. You cannot, you know, cut your relation with the rest of the world for 6 months. This is unacceptable, specific for a country like India, which is claiming to be a democratic country, is claiming to be a secular country.
Okay.
That's quite unacceptable.
All right. Well, Reza, what do you think is key to actually bringing this situation, basically calming it down, or the Kashmiris getting what they want? What's key here? What has to happen?
I think there needs to be a fundamental change within the governance within India. I think that is, you know, what we're seeing is part of what's actually going on right across India. This Hindu government, Hindu supremacist government that has actually come into power is going to be damaging for all sections of Indian society, whether it's in Kashmir or in India or whatever. You know, it's something that's going to be problematic right the way across. And I think one of the things that must happen is that what has been neglected by people in India is this basic issue of Kashmir. And what happens whenever you leave, you let an injustice to fester, that injustice then ultimately spreads and it starts to impact on other people. And people need to recognize they need to start resisting together against this Hindu supremacy, because this is going to target all sections of Indian society right across India.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on the discussion about the situation in Kashmir. Out of London, from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem, and out of Qom, Iran, peace and justice activist and researcher, Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين واللعن الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. One of the most important topics in Islamic ethics is the topic of yaqeen or certainty. The difference between us and the infallible imams and generally infallibles is while we believe in something and we are not certain about it, they believe in something and they are certain. For example, about committing sins. While we know that when we commit sin, inevitably we go to hell, at the same time we commit sin, they believe in the same fact, but they know that committing sin is equal to going to the hell, and they see this fact as we see something by our eyes. So while we are not sure about something that we know, they are sure about the result of everything. As a result, they never commit sin as infallibles, but there is probability and possibility of committing sin by us. Once Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, enters the mosque and meets a young person whose face was pale, was not normal. Prophet asked him, "How are you?" He replied, "I'm at the level of certainty."